I think that there was an internal effort within the administration to change the makeup and the dynamic of the Marijuana Control Board. And part of that was getting me off that board.
The man who helped spearhead the marijuana legalization effort is ousted from the board overseeing it. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the expense of moving military personnel.
The Army could save a bunch of money if we all just were stationed here for 4 or 5 years. It would cut down on the rotation, but it doesn't work that way.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Alaska's congressmen and both U.S. senators are among the Republican lawmakers criticizing remarks Donald Trump made about a family, the family of Captain Humayun Khan, a Muslim American Army officer killed in Iraq. Khan's parents were featured at the Democratic National Convention, and Trump later criticized his mother for remaining silent next to her husband. Trump also compared their sacrifice to those he has made as a real estate developer. Senator Lisa Murkowski says Gold Star families, meaning the survivors of slain service members, deserve unconditional love and support. Donald Trump must honor and respect this most fundamental value, Murkowski said in a written statement. A spokesman for Representative Don Young, in response to a media inquiry, said while Young may not share the Khan's political beliefs, he would never question the pain or sacrifice of a Gold Star family. Young's statement did not include Trump's name. Senator Dan Sullivan, a reserve officer in the Marines, said he condemns any statements, including Trump's recent remarks, that undermine the sacrifice of Khan and his family. Slain service members and war veterans deserve nothing less than steadfast gratitude for their sacrifices, Sullivan says. None of the three lawmakers said they would disavow Trump's candidacy. Murkowski hasn't said whether she will vote for Trump, but she says she's always voted for the Republican nominee in past elections. Young has said he'll probably vote for Trump, depending on who he picks for cabinet posts, and Sullivan has said he supports the Republican nominee. One of the state's key regulators on commercial cannabis has been unexpectedly ousted by the governor.
Bruce Schulte, a former member of the Marijuana Control Board.
Schulte was active in the 2014 ballot initiative that legalized commercial marijuana in Alaska, then served as chair of the Marijuana Control Board, a position with tremendous influence in crafting regulations for the new industry. But he'd recently been voted out of the chairmanship, and last Friday, Schulte, who is a commercial pilot, landed after a flight to find an unexpected voicemail.
I received a call from the governor's office saying that I was being removed from the Marijuana Control Board. No explanation was offered. I've tried to reach out to the head of boards and commissions to get some sort of explanation, and I've received no response back.
A letter signed by Governor Walker thanks Schulte for his service on the board, but concludes that his tenure is no longer in the best interest of Alaska. In an email, the governor's communication director, Grace Jang, wrote that Walker felt it was time for a change and that Schulte's approach to the staff and administrative process was not satisfactory. Jang declined a request for specific examples. In the past, Schulte has clashed with the head of the state agency tasked with developing regulations, Cynthia Franklin. The two have disagreed about specific regulatory policies as well as over the timeline of implementing statewide laws, which critics say placed an unfair burden on the fledgling industry. Schulte believes the makeup of the marijuana board reflected Alaskans' divided opinions on commercialization, with both proponents and skeptics of the new industry giving regulations a measured, conservative shape. He sees the effort to shake up the board's composition as an attempt to change how regulations develop in the coming months.
I think I was subject to some internal politics, and I think that there was an internal effort within the administration to change the the makeup and the dynamic of the Marijuana Control Board, and that part of that was getting me off that board.
Franklin, with the state's Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, declined an interview request on Schulte's departure, referring comments on the subject to the governor's office. However, she responded with a list of the Marijuana Control Board's accomplishments. That list includes setting up the regulatory protocols for the electronic application process, the review of nearly 100 license applications, and meeting deadlines set out in the original voter initiative. Meanwhile, the new chair of the Marijuana Control Board is gathering signatures for an initiative to allow a Kenai Peninsula borough vote on outlawing commercial cannabis operations in areas of the borough outside of cities. The measure could go before voters on the October primary ballot. That isn't sitting well with members of the cannabis industry on the peninsula. KBBI's Jenny Nyman has more.
Peter Mlynarek is the chief of police in Soldotna, a community that instituted a two-year ban on commercial cannabis activity. He's also the chair of the state Marijuana Control Board, and he's a registered signature gatherer on a voter initiative to ban commercial marijuana in the Kenai Peninsula borough outside the cities that have legal authority to determine their own rules. Legally, there's no problem with the intersection of these roles. Outside activity only constitutes an ethical violation when a board member would personally, primarily financially, benefit from an issue before the board. But legal doesn't mean acceptable to many in the commercial cannabis industry on the Kenai Peninsula. Delinda Phelps is working toward opening Peace Frog Botanicals in Kenai in October.
I know from a legal perspective he's not violating any legal code, but I think morally, to play both sides is wrong. I believe that the chair of a board that's set to regulate an industry should not turn around and work against that industry.
Mlynarek says he wanted to be on the board to help regulate the new industry, particularly with an eye toward public safety.
Trying to make sure that as you're starting this new industry, you keep those kind of matters, the public safety type issues in mind as regulations are being crafted, as licenses are being approved, or if there's any enforcement action that needs to be taken.
He said his involvement gathering initiative signatures doesn't affect his work on the board, nor would his personal opinion of commercial marijuana. In fact, he's voted to approve every complete license application that's come before the board.
You can look at my voting record on the board and you'll see that I'm pretty consistent in the way I vote, and I'm not always the most conservative. I didn't deny any of the licenses that came out on the principle that I did or did not like establishments.
He said he supports the initiative because ballot measure 2 gives municipalities the right to opt out of commercial marijuana if residents so choose. He wants the borough to exercise its right to decide.
So when people voted for ballot measure 2, they also voted to allow local governments the option of whether or not they wanted to opt out. My hope is that people will be allowed to vote on that.
Phelps says she doesn't question Mlynarek's right as a citizen to participate in the political process, nor does she say he's been obstructive to the industry in his work on the board. Her concern is the combination of the two.
The intent to work against the industry is the conflict of interest. You cannot work for the industry on a regulatory board and against the industry in your free time.
She says Mlynarek's actions erode trust in the board among the business owners who are investing a lot of money to participate in the new industry. If the initiative petition is approved, the question will appear on the October municipal ballot. I'm Jenny Nyman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, flood control for the Chena.
There's probably a couple hundred tractor-trailer rigs of flood debris that stacked up Wind Road on the other side of the river.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Support for Alaska Public Media comes from First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbaalaska.com.
Every year, the U.S. military moves hundreds of thousands of service members and their families all across the globe. And it isn't cheap. In 2014, the Department of Defense spent more than $4 billion on moving costs. And a federal report found those costs are shooting up much faster than inflation. But as Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, officials don't know where all that money is going, and they're not even tracking enough data to start making reforms.
Standing on his back deck in Birkenstocks, Lieutenant Colonel Alan Brown shows off his backyard in Eagle River, just outside Anchorage. Thickets of trees stand between the yard and the actual Eagle River, but in the winter, you can just glimpse its edges.
We've had moose come right up along the back end of the fence multiple times.
The deck is a peaceful reprieve from the frenzy of packing going on inside. The family's lived in this house for 3 years, and Brown's wife, Christy, tells me that is a streak of stability compared to the 7 moves they've made since getting married. Just in the last few years, they've lived in Texas, Kansas, Colorado, and New York.
We came up here for the stability because before this, we had moved annually, and that got quite challenging.
Postings in Alaska are about a year longer than in the lower 48 because the state technically counts as an overseas rotation, like Korea or Germany. But now the couple are headed back to New York, where Brown will teach English at West Point. He shows me where the movers have started squeezing boxes into wooden crates tall enough to fit a queen-sized mattress with room to spare.
We had 7 crates coming up here. My money's on 8 crates going back just because we've accumulated some stuff. I'm just saying, it's probably 8.
Those crates will make the 4,400-mile trip, first by ship and then by truck. The movers will drive them right up to the Browns' next house and unpack them. And this is where the Defense Department is spending almost 4% of its budget every year, shuffling personnel and their families from place to place. The military calls this a permanent change of station, or PCS. And every time a military family moves, everything they own goes with them, from cherished mementos and kitchenware to the furniture and toys a family just can't seem to shed.
Yeah, that's my scuba stuff. I haven't used those in a long time. When was the last time we went scuba diving?
On our honeymoon.
Yeah.
The military is moving less people as the size of the force draws down, but the moves themselves are getting more expensive, outpacing inflation by 28%. And while there are theories about why, a report last year by the Government Accountability Office looking at more than 10 years of data on the PCS program found essentially that no one is sure of how to account for the rise.
Some of the services report it, some don't. Some of the services report it, but they don't report it for all years.
Brenda Farrell wrote the GAO report and says one of their biggest findings was how inconsistently data on PCS costs is tracked by the Pentagon. And Farrell says there are 2 reasons why this is a problem. It keeps officials from seeing which factors are actually driving PCS costs, and it means the Defense Department isn't regularly evaluating the program to assess whether spending more than $4 billion taxpayer dollars every year is worth it.
And in fact, when we asked the DoD officials during our review, when was the last time an evaluation was made of the PCS program, none of them could recall such an evaluation being done, even though DoD's own guidance requires that they conduct an assessment of factors that may increase or decrease cost.
Farrell's report makes a number of recommendations, but she says so far DoD hasn't acted on any of them. A working group was convened in May, but it won't begin taking steps for at least another 18 months. Defenders say the moves structure military careers and are a piece of spreading skills across the force. As the movers are taking apart an upstairs bedroom, Alan Brown says the PCS program is integral to the Army's mission.
The Army could save a bunch of money if we all just were stationed here for 4 or 5 years. It would cut down on the rotation, but it doesn't work that way because you get folks that get promoted and there's no longer a job for them here. You get folks that really need to go to a new location to expand their skill set and gain new experiences. And so the Army really needs them to move somewhere else and try something new.
The average move for the Army costs close to $7,000, but Brown's move will be more expensive because he's an officer living overseas with a family. He's allowed to bring a lot more stuff. In fact, his allotment is close to 9 tons. But the costs for the PCS program aren't just the freight. The military also pays for the various minor expenses you incur when you pick up your life and move it elsewhere. Reimbursements for mileage, a per diem, a relocation stipend.
You got to go buy mops. You got to go buy cleaning supplies. You got to go buy ketchup and mustard and everything. All the stuff that we can't ship that the Army says we're not allowed to ship that can't go, that we have to leave behind.
Brown isn't sure of the bottom line when you add all these expenses together. The Army never gives him that number. 2 days later, I check back in, and the busy home has been transformed into an empty house.
My wife's Pilates equipment is completely gone. Her desk is gone. Dining room table is gone. And this room is pretty empty. It's more like an echo chamber, actually.
There were some kitchen items and an air mattress left. Enough stuff for Brown, Christy, their two kids, and dog Lucy to house camp for a few days. But it turned out they sent off way more stuff than the 8 crates Brown expected. In the end, it was 14. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Chena River Flood Control Project was built by the Army Corps of Engineers after the devastating 1967 flood in Fairbanks. The project's main features, a dam and connected spillway, protect the community during heavy rains. And as KYC's Dan Bross reports, the facility has gotten heavy use in recent weeks.
The Moose Creek Dam is regulating the Chena River again. Chena Flood Control Project Manager Tim Favel says the dam, which diverts water from the Chena at North Pole to prevent flooding in Fairbanks, was reactivated late Sunday night in response to weekend rains.
So we're diverting water, some of that flood water, into the floodway again. And we'll continue to do that probably for another couple days.
The dam's activation follows 8 continuous days of operation, which ended July 28th. Favel says diverted water is again filling the flood control basin, which looked like a lake last week.
You could canoe all over that out there. And so there was probably, you know, anywhere from just a couple feet up to some places 10 feet deep of water.
Favel notes that the over 3-mile-long dam created lake's peak level last week was the highest recorded since 1994.
Which is interesting. We didn't expect that. And the fish ladder was activated, and we had chums and king salmon even going up using the fish ladder to get upstream and spawn. So that was another twist to this whole thing.
Favel says salmon normally travel through damside channels to get upstream and only need the ladder at higher water levels. Another byproduct of dam operation is the buildup of trees and brush behind its gates, which Favel says a crew was busy removing over the weekend.
There's probably a couple hundred tractor trailer rigs of flood debris that stacked up windrowed on the other side of the river.
Favel says salvaged trees will be made available to the public for firewood at a later date. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
It's being called a marine heat wave. The combination of the strongest El Nino in recent history and the recent warm water anomaly known as the Blob generated the greatest amount of warm ocean water that has ever been recorded. New research has now linked the two phenomena. KTOO's Matt Miller has the story.
The rain pummeling California tonight. This freeway underwater. The deluge stranding cars. This truck pushing one under a bridge.
That's an ABC News story in January on El Nino storm damage in California. The latest phenomenon of equatorial Pacific Ocean warming was the strongest in 2 decades, affecting wind, temperature, and precipitation patterns around the globe. While it did bring some needed precipitation to parts of the drought-stricken West Coast, it was also blamed for plenty of damage.
It's like water hitting a parking lot. The result, mud like this, and more mudslides and floods headed this way, and in their path, these neighborhoods.
After peaking in late 2015, with temperatures at least 2 degrees Celsius above normal, the latest El Nino event has disappeared. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Climate Prediction Center in Maryland says sea surface temperatures have dropped to below average in the eastern equatorial Pacific over the last 2 months. But while El Nino is dead, the blob lives on.
put it in a little bit more colorful terms, kind of lingering hangover.
Nicholas Bond says latest sea surface temperature measurements show unusually warm conditions still persisting, especially in the Gulf of Alaska and Bering Sea.
For the Gulf of Alaska, 2.5 degrees C, warmer than normal, and in parts of the Bering Sea, it's 4 degrees C or 7 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than normal. I noticed some temperatures there near the west coast of Alaska that were 16 degrees C. That's over 60 degrees in the Bering Sea.
Bond is a research meteorologist at the University of Washington and the state climatologist for Washington who first identified the warm water anomaly in the North Pacific 3 years ago that he nicknamed the blob. He says unusual weather patterns have allowed the ocean to retain all of that heat.
It got quite a bit warmer than normal, quite deep depths, as deep as 300 meters or so. And so there was just a tremendous reservoir of extra heat that is taking a long time to go away.
That means Alaskans could expect warmer weather this summer. New research suggests a link between the blob in the North Pacific and the former El Nino in the tropical Pacific.
El Nino was kind of in the middle of the event in terms of changing the pattern of ocean warming and making it last for 3 years.
Nate Mantua is a climate and fisheries research scientist at NOAA's Southwest Fisheries Science Center in Santa Cruz, California. In a paper published in July in the journal Nature Climate Change, Mantua and his co-author examined the connections between the two separate ocean events, despite the great distance between them. The blob's formation in the Western Pacific extratropics, or mid-latitudes beyond the tropics in 2013, could have had a small influence on the development of 2014's tropical El Nino. Then, during the El Nino that developed in 2015, warm temperatures at the equator remotely affected the storm track and weather patterns in the North Pacific extratropics.
The El Nino influence favors a much stormier weather pattern that includes a lot of wind from the south along the coast of the Pacific Northwest into Alaska. And that is what caused the offshore warm blob to move inshore and to expand.
Mantua calls it a marine heat wave, and he says the amount of warm water was dramatically more than any other event in the historical record dating back to 1880. The blob and El Nino tag team is the prime suspect for several unusual biological events along the West Coast in the last 3 years, such as seabird die-offs, giant algal blooms, domoic acid and shellfish, whale and marine mammal strandings, low salmon returns and lightweight salmon, and so on.
This is all indicative of a lot of stress on the marine food web, lower productivity. That's in keeping with this idea of what warm water typically does. It just reduces the ability to get nutrients up into the sunlit upper ocean, and it cuts down on the abundance of the lipid-rich subarctic species that we find at the base of the food web.
Mantua says there's no evidence yet that global warming prompted the recent arrival of the blob, but he and his co-author do believe that such events may happen more often and with greater intensity as the ocean warms. Short-term relief may just be around the corner. Nicholas Bond at the University of Washington says there's an increased chance that the pendulum is swinging the other way this winter toward La Niña, or equatorial cooling. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Big Delta resident Tom Gorman says a small dam he built earlier this year to protect his home from the meandering Tanana River held steady over the past couple of weeks as the rain-swollen river rose to near flood level. But as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, Gorman now hopes the river falls quickly enough to allow him to finish work on the dam before snow flies.
Tom Gorman stands at the edge of a 20-foot-wide slough off the Tanana River that runs along the foot of a ridge on which he built his house about 7 years ago, and says this is not how it looked back then.
Last year, it was dry.
Gorman says a couple dozen trees used to grow in and around the area, which served as a sort of buffer between his big three-story house and the Tanana River some 45 feet away, until January, when an ice dam on the Tanana diverted a torrent of water into the area that tore out the trees and gouged into the riverbank, threatening to undercut the ridge where his house sits.
And that just came in and just took them out one at a time. Pow!
2 hours later, another one. Bam. It just got behind them. The erosion behind them and just ripped them up.
That was near the beginning of an ordeal that lasted for several weeks as Gorman and a small army of friends, neighbors, contractors, and others tried to bust up the pile of thick ice slabs. They attempted to melt it with a de-icing solution. They tried to bust it up with a 5,000-pound weight dropped from a helicopter. They even detonated explosives to blast it open, but nothing worked.
Not on 3-4 foot ice, you know, and that's what you had over here, all the way across.
Gorman says state and federal officials for the most part supported his efforts to save the house. He says he didn't get any help from his homeowner's insurance company, but he got lots from dozens of volunteers from all around the area.
The communities helped me out, and they really pulled together.
Gorman, a retiree from Texas, says the cost of trying to break the ice jam further strained his finances, which he'd already deeply tapped to buy the land and in 2009 build a home for his family, which includes his wife and elderly mom, disabled son, and daughter with kids. Gorman says he's been asked many times, why did he build his dream house so close to the river?
We were safe. We were really safe when we built this house.
He says he followed advice on where to build given by his contractor and two neighbors, both of whom lived along that stretch of the river for more than 40 years. But the ice jam backup surprised everyone, he says, as he showed photos of river water tearing through the slough in frantic efforts to slow its destruction.
It came around this way, and it started cutting in here. It cut in here, and it fell down. Mm-hmm. Cut, and it's headed right toward the house.
Gorman says when the ice jam finally gave way, he and his crew had a chance to bring in equipment to shore up 150 feet of riverbank with big rocks and to build an 8-foot-tall dam across the slough.
What this dam did here was to really stop the current. Once the current was stopped, then I could get in here and do something.
Gorman says when the river rose a couple of weeks ago, he saw the dam built of interlocking concrete barriers wasn't quite high enough, so he laid a course of sandbags on top of it to slow the flow to a trickle.
It's holding, but it's not done. It has to be completed.
But Gorman says he can't bring equipment back in until the river drops and the area dries out.
The water has got to go down because what happens is you put the equipment down there and if it's so soft, it's going to push the dam away.
Gorman says that may not happen before the first snow flies 2 or 3 months from now. He says he'd prefer to do the work before winter sets in, but if he runs out of time, he'll pay the extra cost of doing the work in the winter in order to save his home. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin, Zachariah Hughes, and Graylin Brashear in Anchorage, Jenny Nyman in Kenai, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Matt Miller in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Get a career in less than a year in nursing or QMed or professional cooking and baking. Additional programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January, so enroll now. This message sponsored by Avtech.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.